Right. So I made lots of view graphs. So I'll just go through them. And if there is interest, then people should stop me and ask more questions.
Okay.
Right. So I have lots of collaborators which are listed here. So maybe Joop Shea, Anthony Aguirre, and Emmanuel Rollin are my main collaborators at the moment. So I have a student, Craig Booth, and I should show you at the end what he has been doing. So you remind me of that. So what I'm going to talk in this lunchtime talk, specials of the day, I'm going to talk about the subject of this workshop. How do you observe the IGM, the intergalactic medium in quasar spectra? Maybe a little bit more detail than usual. I want to say something about continuum fitting and the problem inherent to Schell spectrographs. I'm not an observer, this is just hearsay. Okay. Then I'll tell you a little bit about how a quasar spectrum is built up, in case you didn't know that, the Lamin alpha forest metal lines. And then I'll contrast that with a theoretical paradigm. And of course, the nice thing is that this theoretical paradigm is relatively simple and predicts the, and looks very much like the like the observations. And since the observations are very good, okay, that's very unusual. So we have a model that you would think we can really test something like, for example, feedback. And then I want to talk a little bit about the pixel optical depth method as a new method of comparing simulated mock simulations with observations. And then I'll show applications to metal pollution, which is mostly Anthony and Joop's work, and the UV background, which is something I've been working on a bit. So here's a quasar spectrum, so counts converted from electrons in your CCD versus wavelength. And so you see the intrinsic Lamin alpha profile of the quasar. So this is due to the quasar. The quasar has some profile, which of course, some intrinsic profile, which we don't know, which we would only know if we were close to it. And so there's lots of absorption lines, most of which we think are intervening. They're due to intervening systems as the photons move towards us. So this part is the Lamin alpha forests, for a redshift 3 quasar. The length of this thing is about of the order 400 co-moving megaparsecs, so just such, think of some scale to think of that, right? 400 co-moving megaparsec, whereas maybe the proximity region of the quasar is maybe 10, so a large fraction of, we're looking at intergalactic space far from sources, well, at least far from the very bright quasar that we're looking at. So the bottom panel is the, so I showed the Keck spectrum, I'm using UV spectrum as well, but this is the Keck spectrum. So the essence of the Keck spectrum and of the UV, these high resolution spectra, are that they resolve the lines, okay? So the line width is set by the, whatever it sets the line width, it's not by the spectrograph. And the signal to noise is little wiggles on top, is very high, okay? So Keck and VLT here. It used to be that these lines were thought of galaxies, we're looking at galaxies, whereas now we know that it's mostly intervening systems. So what I want to say about the Schell spectrograph, so this is the spectrum as you get it from a telescope, well this is a supernova, not a quasar, okay. And so you need to combine these different Schell orders in order to construct your spectrum, okay. And then you have the problem that the sensitivity of the CCD of course varies with position and with color. Okay, and so somehow you have to stitch these bits together, and again, to have some physical idea, the length of one Schell order is typically of, in the Lamin alpha forest, is typically of the order of 20 megaparsecs. So if you look, so a single Lamin alpha forest region will consist of several Schell orders, which somehow you have to stitch together. Right? And so the trick with that is that, so what you want to do is say something about the physics, that is the fraction of light is which is observed, okay. Whereas what the only thing you see is the observed flux, okay? And so you know, what is the emitted flux? And so to estimate this, okay, is called, you know, data reduction in the art of continuum fitting. You have to assume something about what is the spectrum of the quasar, okay? So that you know what this is, and then you can divide your observed flux by the emitted flux and say what is the physics that you're actually looking at. Now, in high-resolution spectra, what is usually assumed, certainly at low redshift, is that in between the lines, I saw you several lines, in between the lines there's no absorption, okay, and so that's where the continuum is. That's if there's no absorption and the observed flux is the emitted flux, okay. This is almost certainly not true at high redshifts. Certainly you see that in simulations, that the flux never recovers to the continuum, okay, and so certainly for high-resolution observations at high redshift, we introduce some bias in our data reduction, which we try to put in the simulations as well. So I'll talk about the simulations a bit. Okay. Right. So let me stop there unless anybody says something.
Can you say something about the size of that bias? How far are you from the
Very good question. So observationally, you don't know, right?
Okay.
And so when comparing, for example, the mean absorption, so you can say, so fine, we see lots of lines, but what is the mean amount of light that is absorbed? If you compare high-resolution observations, which have this way of continuum fitting that I described, versus low-resolution observations, who estimate the continuum by extrapolating from the red side, okay, because you, in low resolution you can't see in between the lines, so they can't do the same thing, okay, but they can continuum normalize their spectra, extrapolate from the red to the blue and see what fraction is missing, okay, and these estimates differ quite a bit, okay, and so who is wrong? Well, probably both to some extent. Right, so the theoretical paradigm is very simple. So there's two ingredients, there's structure formation and an ionizing background. Structure formation we all know, of course, you go from WMAP to the Hubble volume, we know exactly where the dark matter is. It used to be that the cosmological parameters are uncertain, but now we know them, don't we? So, in a sense, we know where the dark matter is. We need an ionizing background, because if there weren't, then we wouldn't see the blue side of the quasar spectra. Okay, so we know that the IGM is very highly ionized. However, what produces this ionization, okay, we're not so sure about. Okay, we know that quasars produce ionizing photons. Maybe galaxies contribute extensively as well, but the fraction as a function of redshift, I think, is still pretty uncertain. And when this starts as a function of redshift, is maybe even more uncertain. So the one bit of physics that I want to show you is the physics of photoionization. Okay, because people seem to keep on making the same mistakes. I want to explain you once and for all. So, well, not all people, not the people here, but okay. So suppose you have sources that produce an ionizing flux in J of nu as a function of frequency. Okay, if I divide J of nu by H of nu, I get the number of photons. Okay, I multiply by the photoionization cross section. Suppose there's only hydrogen in the universe. Integrate from the hydrogen ionization edge to infinity, that's the photonization rate, okay? So J is what the quasars produce, you integrate that over the photonization cross-section of hydrogen, which we know, you get a photonization rate in photonizations per second, okay? Now if I do the same integration, but I multiply in the integral with the difference between the photon energy and how much energy is necessary to ionize the hydrogen, then I get a heating rate. That's the kinetic energy of the electron, the extra kinetic energy once it's ionized. Once it shares that with all the other people in the intergalactic medium, that represents the temperature. And so that's the photoheating rate. Okay? So both proportional to J. Okay? So that's the red equations. So for a uniform IGM, you can expect to something happen like this. So this is redshift. Okay? So coming from high redshift, all of a sudden something produces ionizing photons. As a consequence, when this happens, the universe gets reionized. You get a temperature of about 10 to the 4, although I think that value is quite uncertain. And afterwards is the combination, it's the balance between the universe expanding and hence adiabatically cooling down and being photoheated by the process that I just described, which describes what the temperature evolution is afterwards. So that's for a uniform IGM. The IGM is not uniform, so you have to see how things depend on density. So these are the two equations I showed you before. And this shows you the physics of photonization. So N is the neutral density in hydrogen atoms. Rho is the total density. So you can change from neutral to ionized, okay, by recombining. That increases the neutral density. Alpha is the recombination rate, and you need an electron and a proton to recombine. So it goes like the density squared. Okay, and here's the photonization. Okay. And so here is the heating, the photonization heating rate. So this is the change in thermal energy every time you ionize a neutral atom. Okay. So then the trick is to combine these equations, and then you get something like this. Okay. So assume the IGM is in photonization equilibrium, then this thing is zero. Okay. And so you can compute the neutral fraction, which will depend on the recombination rate, the photonization rate, and the density. Okay. So you can immediately see that the denser gas, okay, if rho is higher, it's a higher neutral fraction. Okay, so now we have the neutral fraction here. We can compute the heating rate. The heating rate here is epsilon n divided by rho. Epsilon n divided by rho. So it depends on the recombination rate, so the temperature of the gas, the photoheating rate, the photonization rate, and the density. Okay, so remember that both epsilon and gamma are proportional to the flux of ionizing photons. Okay, and so to first order, the heating rate is independent of the flux of ionizing photons. It depends on the spectrum, but not on the rate. Okay. And the other thing you see is that the heating rate is higher as the gas density is higher. Okay. So you heat the denser gas more in photonization heating.
Alpha
per unit volume, per unit volume.
Then why it throws roll rather than n squared?
Ah, it's because I assume here, well pointed out, that the gas is very highly ionized. Okay, so that, so it should be Ne times NH, right?
And why the gram squared?
Yeah, there is a,
there's a mass of the proton mass missing or something.
So
yeah.
Alpha must be defined as your combination rate
per gram. Then, yes, but I should have put an MH, but I mean, there's fractions of gamma they're missing. This is, these are not the right equations, they just behave the right way. So,
so what part of those equations do people get wrong?
No, no, no. I'm just saying, for example, I was saying this is the thermal energy per unit mass, but then you have to have a Boltzmann constant and mean molecular weight and things like that. Was that what you meant?
No, I was referring to your previous comment. These are equations that sometimes people get wrong.
Right, no, people, well, what people keep on getting wrong is say, you have the temperature too low, why don't you increase the ionizing background?
No.
For example, it does. That doesn't work.
It depends on the spectrum.
It depends on, you can make it harder, yes. So this is, so previously I showed you the temperature as a function of redshift at the mean density, so here is how it looks at different densities. And so what I want to point out is that most, so this is an SPH simulation, and most of the volume in the universe is sitting here, okay? So you see few particles, there's few particles because I removed them, otherwise you don't see them, it's like black. And so I put red contours here where most of the particles are, okay? And so you have this very very tight temperature density relation, so this redshift 2, redshift 3, and so you see that that this thing has a slope in it. It has a slope because lower density gas, to get to lower density, has to expand more, okay, so it cools more. At the same time, lower density gas gets heated less, okay, so that develops this slope in the equation of state, or temperature density relation. So anyway, so these are the main ingredients that go into a simulation. So you start, we know the cosmological conditions now, cosmological parameters. We assume an ionizing background, and out comes mock spectra. Okay, and so this is a comparison of one of these high-resolution observations with a simulation, and you can stare at this for a while, and they look similar if you count. If you see, like, how many narrow lines do I have, how many broad lines do I have, you can stare at it, and that's actually maybe one of the problems. So you get these spectra now, how do you compare them in more detail? You can stare at them, fine. You want some number, don't you? So let me skip this one. So traditionally what is done is to fit these lines, okay, because the idea is that these individual clouds are void profiles, aren't they? And so your spectrum should be a sum of void profiles, and so this is a VP fit. So where you try to write the spectrum, which is the dark blue line, it's the light blue line, as a sum of void profiles. Void profiles are the red lines, okay? And so you can see that although this works reasonably well for some lines, for example, this component here, you fit reasonably well by a single void profile, as soon as you get slightly stronger lines, okay, you need many components per system, okay? And this is not very well defined. Void profiles are not basis functions. This is not, there's nothing unique about this decomposition, okay? But of course the nice thing is that once you have the void profiles, you can make like column density plots, for example, and you can compare the column density distribution of your observations to the data, okay? So each void profile has position, a width in kilometers per second, say, and a column density, how many neutral atoms per square centimeter, and then you can compare statistics B and N between simulations and data, or some combination of that. Yeah? So I have no answer to that. The only thing I can think of is I'll make my mock spectra as similar as possible as the observations, and I use the same program. And there's no guarantee that that's a good thing to do. Yes?
In practice, you pick the front lines always first, and then the residuals, adding in weaker lines. Mm-hmm. Weaker lines where it's arbitrary.
Yes.
So
yeah.
How many combinations do you get to?
Well, I mean, in a sense, for given VP fit, it will come up with this. You know, if you run it twice, you get exactly the same answer. So the point is that I use the program as the algorithm to decide where to put lines, Okay, and since it's a program, it always gives me the same answer. So
I guess it's based on a chi-square.
It's a chi-square, but then it still depends on where you put your guess. And
but
yes.
In the alliance, it's based on nice little rituals, right? So it's still based on chi-squares. But then when you how you have initial guess at that line, you add in, you have to guess its contents in the upper term. I don't know how they did their automated algorithm, but that's somebody's choice. It's not.
Yes.
But
yeah.
The question is how it defines, the result. I mean, how you have a chi-square, meaning chi-square, considering how wide is the, how deep is the meaning, how...
But you have to really check the fitting function, so it's not even the
Yeah.
You can actually decide to add another line, another line, the other line, right?
Yes.
Or have to let that line go based on chi-square. I don't know how it works.
Well, I mean,
there is a subjective choice. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the hard part. It's pretty good, robust. I think it will be similar other than the weak one. So, looking up here on the top here, I worry about that 25. The ones that are very small, optical depths, those are the ones that are going to be arbitrary.
So, why don't you think like PBX and correlation function and things like that?
Of what? Of the flux? Of the flux?
Yeah.
People have used that as well. So for some things, I think it works. For example, these are simulation results. So the crosses are lines. So the four profiles that I've just shown you. So it's column density versus B parameter. The crosses are individual lines. There's no error bars. And so the difference between the two simulations is the temperature of the gas. Okay, the temperature of the gas. You decrease it, the lines become narrower. You can see that. So it's not completely arbitrary. There is definitely some relation between B and N and the physics that go in the simulation. So let me skip some of these. So I want to say a little bit about the new method of, new between quotes, the way to analyze, people have been using this for a while, which is called the pixel optical depth method. And the way this works, and I want to explain this in a little bit detail, because it also shows you how a quasar spectrum is built up. So suppose you have a quasar with redshift 3, okay? So the bottom panel is redshift, the top panel is the corresponding wavelength, okay? If you assume a transition, so redshift 3, so then the red line will be the Lyman alpha emission, okay? And the blue one will be the corresponding Lyman beta emission line of the quasar, okay? Now suppose you have an absorbing cloud sitting at redshift 2.9, okay? And it will produce its Lyman alpha absorption there and its corresponding Lyman beta absorption there. Okay? And so suppose again there's only hydrogen in the universe, every time you see an absorption line between the blue and the red, you know it's Lyman alpha. Okay? But as soon as you go left of the blue, then an absorption line here can either be Lyman beta of a corresponding Lyman alpha line, okay, or it can be a Lyman alpha line of an absorber sitting at a completely different redshift. Okay, and so this is the way, and so that's why this part of the spectrum is called the Lyman alpha forest, because it's always Lyman alpha if it's hydrogen. Okay, whereas here you get contamination of Lyman alpha by Lyman beta, and then later you get Lyman gamma, Lyman delta. Okay, so that's the first thing. Okay, now the second thing. Suppose this was a cloud. This cloud has some temperature. Correspondingly, its spectrum won't be a delta function, but will have some broadening. So there's thermal broadening. Okay. So even if the gas has a unique density, a unique temperature, you get a range of optical depths, obviously. Right. Okay. So the relation between optical depth and density, so we're going to use the optical depth instead of Voigt profile fitting to say something about the density structure in the IGM. Okay. And we know from the outset that that relation cannot be one-to-one. Okay. Now, so there's one last thing, where the pixel optical depth method, which I'm describing at the moment, really comes into its own. That's when the optical depth is large, because if the optical depth is large, okay, so this is the same line as I showed you, except that the column density is higher, if the optical depth is large, then the flux is zero within the noise. And if the flux is zero, then you can't take the logarithm of the flux, because that's not allowed, right? So what can you do in the pixel optical depth net, and what do you do? Well, if Lyman alpha is saturated, then maybe Lyman beta is not, because the oscillator strength is weaker, so the same current density will produce a weaker line in Lyman beta, okay? And so you can go to Lyman beta, measure the optical depth there, and say, what is this higher density, okay? Except that you don't know, which the reason I explained to you just before, that if you go to the Lyman beta region, you don't know whether the absorption that you're looking at is actually Lyman beta or an intervening Lyman alpha, okay? So maybe you can better check whether Lyman gamma is also consistent. And so in the pixel optical depth method, you look at all 30 transitions of hydrogen at the same time to try to put a minimum optical depth that is consistent with the spectrum that you observe, okay? So that's the pixel optical depth method. And so from realistic simulations, and I'll describe, I don't know if I have time, what that means. So the realistic spectra, so people usually, so they run a simulation, they stop the simulation at redshift 3, and then they make a spectrum, okay, and then they compare that spectrum to observations. But of course, the observations I just showed you are over a large redshift range, because if you see absorption in the quasar spectrum, it might well be absorption in the Milky Way, okay? So you really need the whole intergalactic medium from redshift 0 to redshift of the quasar, to make sure that you have all the transitions in your spectrum, okay? So that's what we try to do in these simulations. So we, while the simulation is running, we have thousands of sight lines which we store, from which we later compute the spectrum. And so we combine these thousands of sight lines to a single quasar spectrum that goes from redshift 1.7, actually, to the redshift of the quasar, okay? And then we add all the other instrument effects like signal to noise and the spectral resolution of the quasar to that. Okay, so our mock spectra, we try to make them look as much as possible to actually an actual observed spectrum. So we match the wavelength range of quasar 1422, say, to our mock spectrum.
And
fine.
Are metals
just ignorable? So they're not ignorable. Okay. But so what we try to do, which is at the end, but I don't think I'll get there, is to try, for example, to distribute metals in a different way, in one way, in another way, and then analyze the spectrum to see whether you can tell the difference between the two. So that's what I was just saying, I guess. This is just how well or not the pixel optical depth recovery works. So as a function of redshifts, so this is one of these simulated mock spectra that has a large redshift range, plot the true optical depth, so in logarithmic units, okay? Now the black line is the optical depth in the simulations, okay? So once we have the optical depth in the simulation, you know, you compute the you add noise, you compute the flux, okay? You make the mock spectrum, and then you try to recover it, okay? And so the recovered one is the red one, okay? Now, how well does this work? So you see that the red one stops here, okay? That's below an optical depth of 0.1, given the signal to noise in the spectra below an optical depth of 0.1, the flux is consistent with no absorption. Okay, so that's why we said, well, below 0.1, there's just too little absorption. We can't measure the optical depth accurately. So that's why it stops here. But you see that over quite a large range in optical depth, the recovery follows the true optical depth quite accurately. Okay, and in fact, you'll see that it becomes worse around an optical depth of 5. That's because between 3 and 8. That's because then Lyman alpha is too strong, the flux is zero, and Lyman beta is not strong enough. Okay, so above these large optical depths of 8, 5, it becomes better again. So now the nice thing is, of course, that instead of using the flux and line fitting, you could try to use the optical depth, and because there's a reasonably tight correlation between optical depth and density, you can try to say something about density, okay? In equations, let's forget about that. So one of the nice things about the pixel optical depth method in that sense is that it allows you to scale things, okay? So what people usually do is what it is described, where you change something to your simulations, you compute a flux and compare to data, okay? And then you change something else to your simulations and you compare again. I think What did I do?
How did you do that?
Okay. Right. So I think the nice thing about the pixel optical depths in comparison to data is that it will allow you to interpret the data directly. Okay, so you can test your methods on your simulations, but then you can apply it to data without having to calibrate at any stage. Okay, for example, here. So here's an example. So this optical depth in different percentiles as a function of redshift. Okay. And so this is so the blue one are the true is the true optical depth, which I know in my simulations, and the red one is the evolution of those percentiles using only the recovered optical depth. Okay, and so because you saw that it recovers the optical depth pixel by pixel, it's not a surprise that it recovers the percentiles very well as well. Fine. So this is in contrast to what people
in the optical depth, Lyman alpha optical depth.
This is the Lyman alpha optical depth. So these are percentiles. So you look at the given redshift range, okay? You plot you compute a cumulative distribution, and you plot the value of the optical depth at several percentiles. So I think it's like 90, 80, 70, 60 or something, okay? So contrast this to what people usually do. They talk about the mean flux, okay? They write as e to the power minus effective optical depth, okay? But it's, of course, a very nonlinear relation between this effective optical depth and the true optical depth. For example, if you increase the ionizing background by a factor of 2, then it's not necessary that the effective optical depth also decreases by a factor of 2, whereas the true optical depth will. So, 5 minutes, 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes? Five minutes. So let me just show you two things. So this is one of the things that we recently found. So what is plotted here is this cumulative distribution of optical depth, okay? Either the true or the recovered. I think this is from simulations, okay? So log tau and the fraction of pixels that have a log tau below some value, okay? So it goes to 1. So the different lines here are the different redshifts, okay, in the simulation. Fine. We know that as the universe becomes denser at high redshift, it absorbs more. Fine, we know that, right? So the bottom panel here is where you scale the optical depth, okay, so a different redshift, to the same redshift using one smooth function, okay? The idea being that the main effect of this expansion of the universe is that the mean density changes, and so there's some scaling optical depth that changes, okay? And so we fit this scaling optical depth and then put these different cumulative distributions on top of each other, and they fall almost exactly on top. What that means is that most of the evolution in optical depth is just the fact that the mean changes and not that structure forms. Okay, if structure formation was very important, then they wouldn't fall on top of each other. Okay, the fact that is of course because the redshift range is not huge, between 2 and 3. Okay, so between 2 and 3, to some good approximation, you can neglect structure formation and just see the universe expanding. So, precision cosmology. So what I'm plotting here is the recombination coefficient as a function of temperature. Okay. Now, it's the recombination coefficient as divided by a function that which is in cloudy that gives the recombination coefficient as a function of temperature. Okay. So it's in units of this fit by Ferland, which is in cloudy. Okay. And the other colors are other fits in the literature, okay? So this wiggly line here is the data that Ferland used to fit this function, okay? And so you see, well, you know, within 10%, the fitting function fits the actual data, okay? But now look at some of these others, which are often used in the literature, okay? So you see easily, well, this one is nice. It just veers off to infinity, okay? And these are also, so this is the one which is in Chen. This is the one is in my simulation, which is Chen divided by something, because I noticed that it doesn't go well. It doesn't work well, okay? Now, why? So this is the hydrogen recombination coefficient. Now, if you look at other, so the reason I'm showing you this one is that this one works particularly well, okay? If you look at different fits for helium or for other processes, they differ by much more than this here. So this is just something to worry about. I will now. So, but I'm just saying that.
Do we know that Ferland is right and the other are wrong?
Not necessarily. I think these are experiments, yes. But I'm not sure for all these others where these are based on. Not necessarily. So, so this is what I was saying about metals. So this is distributing metals in a simulation, for example, homogeneously. Okay, so these are simulations without feedback. You distribute a metal somehow, and you try to recover that. Let me make sure that I show you the last plot. Let me show you this one. Let me show you the new toy. So in the Institute for Computational Cosmology, we have a new computer. Every blue drawer there is two processors. and so recently, we've been playing with the flash code. So far, I've always been using SPH, but recently, we've been using the flash code. So the first thing we run is the Santa Barbara cluster. So flash is an MPI AMR code, which is publicly available. And so you know, in a region of high density, you can ask flash to refine. The refinement criterion is pretty, maybe we should discuss this at some stage with other people that use that, because the PPM scheme, very good for capturing shocks, doesn't work particularly well in cosmology, where you have low densities and very high velocity fields there. Okay. So I think, so then, so because of these numerical inaccuracies, your code will crash. Okay. You have to do something. And so the refinement criteria, which would be ideal for hydrodynamics, don't really work in cosmology, I think. So I think this one, you know, we're just playing with it. It's just based on the density, okay? Whereas usually in flash, it's based on the second derivative of the density. So the last thing I want to show you is what we were talking about last week, that is how to set up refined initial conditions. So for AMR, I think where AMR will come in its own is not to do full cosmology simulations, but to do re-simulations of galaxies. I think that's where it will come into its own. And so what you need is an initial conditions generator that, as you come closer to the region of interest, generates the initial conditions with finer and finer, shorter and shorter waves. And so Ed Bertzinger, I think following in a day by Whaley Penn, has implemented something that works very well for that. Because normally, when generating initial conditions, you generate your random numbers in K-space, and Fourier space, of course, doesn't know which region you're interested in. And so if you want to add small scales, although you're only interested in the small scales where your objects form, you have to add small scale power everywhere. Okay, and that rapidly becomes very hard to do. Whereas the Graphic 2 package will generate the random numbers in real space. Okay, and so you only add small scale power in real space where you want it. So of course up to you to decide where it's interesting. So that sounds very nice. The problem is that Graphic 2 is very hard to use. Okay, it's very difficult to understand what is going on. And so my student, Craig Boot, I convinced him to write an IDL interface, okay, which looks a bit like that, where all you see is this friendly interface to Graphic. Okay? And so what all that this program does, this IDL program does, is to write a C-shell script, okay, that you then let loose on Graphic. Okay? And so one of the things that that Craig also added is you generate random numbers. What you want is that, for example, if you do boxes at different resolutions, that the large-scale modes are the same. Okay? Now in K-space, that's relatively easy to do, but in real space, you can also do that if you're clever in the way you if you're clever in how you generate random numbers. Okay, so I think we have that working so that, for example, if you have a big box, say 100 megaparsec, you can put a smaller box somewhere at small scale power. If you then say, actually, this box, I want it to be not there, but a little bit shifted to the right, okay, then in the region of overlap, you'll get the same structure, identical structure, except for the, of course, this whole way of combining large scale power and small scale power has its intrinsic inaccuracies in it, so it's not exactly the same, but within Graphic accuracy, it is exactly the same. So for example, that is shown here, maybe not very clear. So the left box is simulated at full resolution everywhere, okay, whereas in the right box, only in the center is small scale power added, but it's the same small scale power in the center here as that you have there, okay. So once we're happy that this program works, we'll probably put this on the web. And There's a finite number of random numbers?
Yeah. Well, with the generator.
Right. That's pretty large, though.
Yeah, but if you go down a lot of labels, a lot of
cells. Okay. So there are some sophisticated algorithms on the web there. I don't know what their periodicity is, but
it's
finite, yes. So I think that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.